So the portfolio team is actually part of that GBL, mm-hmm. and they build scalable solutions and scalable architectures for AI. So this mm-hmm. is really the delivery now, the stuff that we can deliver together with our cooperation partners, the hyperscalers and so on. So we built reusable, scalable solutions for that. And one of the roles of the lab is actually delivering new insights into that. So if we have findings that we think should be scaled up, we cooperate on that.
Welcome to the Chief AI Officer Podcast,
where AI meets leadership.
And here is your host, Sanjay Puri.
Welcome to the CAIO Podcast, where we delve deep into the world of Chief AI Officers, exploring their journeys, insights, and challenges in steering AI initiatives within their organizations. I am your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we have a distinguished guest with us, Dr. Robert Engels. Dr. Bob is the Vice President, CTO AI, and Head of the Capgemini AI Lab. Capgemini is a global leader in partnering with companies to transform and manage their businesses by harnessing the power of technology. In 2023, the group reported global revenues of 22.5 billion euros, and it operates with a diverse team of 340,000 members in over 50 countries. Dr. Bob, thank you so much for joining us today. Can you, for our global audience made up of policymakers, CEOs of AI companies, practitioners of AI, can you give them a brief overview of your career journey and your current role at Capgemini?
Sure, Sanjay. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for having me.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So I used to say my AI life started before the internet. which made some of my young colleagues ask me, how can you do AI without a computer? That was quite an interesting discussion. So I started at the University of Amsterdam at Cognitive Psychology and AI, which was really very young, I think. We introduced neural network courses in 92, I think, at the university. I've been living in Sweden, doing my master's in Sweden at the Stockholm University, and then I did my PhD in Germany with Mercedes-Benz and Deutsche Telekom projects at the University of Karlsruhe, the technical university, now called KIT, Karlsruhe Institute of Technology, before I moved to Norway. And in Norway, I did everything. Nobody wanted to actually employ AI people. So I started with startups and I did my own startups. I worked for a municipality, built a museum with AI, an experience center driven by AI. Worked with broadcasters for production with AI, so whole architectures. I did a lot of different things before I felt that I was old enough to actually try to build teams in a larger company. And then I went to Capgemini, where I actually joined in 2018, I think, so 6 years ago. And there I'm now leading the AI lab. So I started with an AI lab in the Nordics, but that was pre-ChatGPT. Mm. And so there was still not really a pool in the market for that. And now it's the other way around. So it's pretty interesting times, I would say, as you can imagine.
Yeah. So from the time where people would not even consider hiring people who were coming out with AI degrees to the time when there's such a talent war, it's been an amazing journey for you, Dr. Bob. And you've been in Sweden, you've been in Norway, you've been in Amsterdam, you've been in Germany. So you've got a very wide variety of experience. Capgemini, Dr. Bob, has been at the forefront of AI adoption and innovation. Can you tell our listeners some key focus areas for the Capgemini AI Lab and how does it contribute to Capgemini's overall AI strategy?
That's a very good question. The lab is a lab, so we don't really have delivery and sales responsibility mm-hmm. with the lab, of course. Mm-hmm. So in Capgemini, we have divided the whole AI ecosystem in three horizons. So horizon one is really the now, what are we delivering now? So there we have portfolio offerings, we have delivery people, and so on. Mm-hmm. The lab takes care of the horizon two and three, which is what's next in 6 months and what's after that again, 1 and 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. We got four responsibilities, which is really the research, which is the thought leading internally, but also externally, which is the internal readiness. So what kind of capabilities do we need? What kind of capabilities do our people need to learn and so on? And we do pioneering collaborations, we call it, which is actually innovative projects with our clients, i.e. projects that actually can fail. So it is really innovative projects, things that are not in the market yet, that we see a potential in together with our clients or the clients on their own. And we support them in that. But that is the responsibility of the lab on a group level. Explicitly, I try to keep the team small. So we have 10 people globally. That I aim at keeping them very diverse. And that's also necessary, I think. We need a lot of different competencies. But I don't want to have a huge team for this kind of work. So it's very small, very agile, and very competent.
Well, that's fantastic. So is it like a think tank for an AI for Capgemini, Dr. Engel, Dr. Bob?
Well, yeah, you might call me Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob is a fun, it's Jack Randall from the 80s. He did the Linus magazine query and answering things.
Yes.
I always thought that when I'm old enough, I call myself Dr. Bob.
I love that name. I love that name.
So that's why. No, but back to the question. So we do different things. So we do, of course, the research into the startups on the global level, which kind of startups pop up, what is the needs. We keep an eye on the business leaders. So the people, probably many of you listening to the podcast as well. So what is your ideas? What is your wishes? And what are your challenges and how you want to be supported? We combine that, of course, with our own insights, the analysts and so on. And from there, we make thought leading. So that is really the thought leading part. But like I said, we also have these pioneering collaborations. We do build demos. We have some spearheads that we work with in the lab where we then actually build stuff and show it in early phases so that if we see that this is a way to go, that we can demonstrate it early to our clients again. Yeah. And I think that makes a lot of sense, basically, because you get some early experience. You get some very good reach out to builders, the organizations that build stuff. We are a system integrator. We rebuild stuff. We join academic projects as well, EU projects and the like. So R&D. So we work with R&D departments of our customers. We had some very good successes in the beginning of Corona where an R&D pharmaceutical R&D department worked with our PhDs to actually, for example, get down the time for DNA resequencing from a few days to a few hours with the help of AI. That's the kind of things we do. It's all about innovation with new technology.
Of course. You mentioned academia. So do you have collaborations with the academic and research institutions, Dr. Bob?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and we also invest in spin-offs. So, for example, we recently invested in a spin-off from MIT called Liquid AI, which does a different thing than the traditional AI company. Or I call them traditional now after 1.5 years with ChatGPT. Sorry.
Yes.
We know the hyperscalers building LLMs and diffusion models and so on. We think there might also be different algorithms that you could use with good success, and we're actively investing in those as well. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, Dr. Bob, that as the world of AI is on steroids, it changes every day. It's just impossible to keep up. How does your lab or how does Capgemini stay ahead of the curve and continuously adapt your capabilities?
Yeah, that is definitely by cooperating with academia. I didn't answer that one yet, but we do have cooperations with universities, with business schools, and so on a global level, besides of these investments in startups and spin-offs. So that's one way we do it. On the other hand, we have 340,000 people. So we have some communities in Capgemini that actually test and try out new models that come on the market. This is really a thing that, like you said, it's going fast now. So there's many new models every day
that's
coming up. And there is, I think, 250,000 plus on Hugging Face and so on, but we're not able to test all of them, of course. And the lab is not doing that work into detail either. So we do that with our broader community in Capgemini for all different sectors and different cases and tasks. And then we have our own ventures department that actually keeps an overview on what comes up with startups. Then the bigger models like Mistral, like Anthropic and so on, that these bigger models we are, of course, testing and working with closely. You can expect Mistral as a European, that we have a closer contact there. But we also cooperate with Anthropic and others. Yeah, definitely.
Oh, that's amazing. Now, one thing you mentioned, and part of this is lessons or messages to your colleagues and peers. There is a venture arm within Capgemini that is also out there looking for new technologies. So that's like a 1-2 punch that you collaborate with them while you work on established players, whether it's Mistral, Anthropic, others. So that really helps from your standpoint, and that's an important thing to do. Can you highlight some of the more innovative AI projects or use cases that Capgemini has been involved in, and talk about a little bit about the impact on the industries or the clients, Dr. Bob?
Yeah, we have, of course, Capgemini is global. Mm-hmm. We work in all sectors, in all regions of the world. So there's a mm-hmm. lot going on, as you can imagine.
Sure.
There's many things we cannot openly speak about.
Of course.
Their NDA. Mm-hmm. But one thing that is published is this cooperation with Liquid AI, for example. And the case there that I really like, the demo, mm-hmm. is that what they've done there is actually use that technology for autonomous car driving, so steering mm-hmm. of an autonomous car. Mm-hmm. with Liquid AI. And you can imagine computer vision, like a Tesla does, like other cars do, mm-hmm. that uses deep learning neural networks typically, and they're quite extensive. There are millions of parameters and so on. Mm-hmm. Now, with Liquid AI, you can do that with 19 neurons, and you get mm-hmm. better results, better filtering of the input, and a more accurate decision space. And of course, a very low footprint compared with the large model. So this is a success history. We need to find out how to commercialize that and how to actually use that. But the technology, of course, is exciting. And that's where we are with the lab.
No, that's fantastic. Dr. Bob, what role do some of these emerging technologies like quantum edge and neuromorphic computing play in your AI roadmap? And how do you prepare for their potential impact?
Very good. So in Capgemini, we have something called the TIV Council, Technology, Innovation, and Ventures. Mm-hmm. Within that council, we have these labs. So I'm part of the council, and my mm-hmm. lab, the AI lab, is one of the labs in that council. The other labs are quantum, metaverse, 5G, mm-hmm. 6G, mm-hmm. Synthetic biology, you name it. Mm-hmm. And we're all working together on tasks. So we have cooperation with metaverse and AI, with multi-agent systems. We have cooperation with a quantum lab on alternative compute for AI. Neuromorphic computing, you mentioned, is also a part of this alternative compute mm-hmm. That we look into. Yeah, all these things come together in these labs. And sometimes I do it with the AI lab alone. Sometimes I do it with an external customer or with a research department from a research institute. Or we do it together with our own labs. But all with the goal of actually getting this thing ahead and further.
Yeah. So, Dr. Bob, you talked about how you work across so many different vertical industries and so many geographies. How do you deal with the challenge of scaling your AI solutions across so many different variables like industries and geographies?
Yeah, good question. So in Capgemini, we have one GBL, a global business line called IND, Insights and Data, which mm-hmm. is really all about scaling solutions. Mm-hmm. So the portfolio team is actually part of that GBL, mm-hmm. and they build scalable solutions and scalable architectures for AI. So this mm-hmm. is really the delivery now, the stuff that we can deliver together with our cooperation partners, the hyperscalers, and so on. So we build reusable, scalable solutions for that. Mm-hmm. And one of the roles of the lab is actually delivering new insights into that. So if we have findings that we think should be scaled up, we cooperate on that with mm-hmm. these internal departments. Yeah, definitely.
We do. Wonderful. Also, Dr. Bob, as a CTO AI, how do you balance exploring cutting-edge AI research, but simultaneously also delivering tangible business value to your clients? Because some of these technologies are so exciting, agents, super agents, multimodal, et cetera. But your clients probably also are saying, hey, where's the ROI for some of these things? How do you balance that part, Dr. Bob?
To be quite blunt, Dutch, that's not my problem.
That's a great answer.
Exactly. So what I do say to our salespeople and market units is that if you get to a customer and you find a need for AI, something that we can deliver, you don't call me. You call me if you can't deliver it or if it's something that's so innovative that it doesn't exist yet. So that's how we do that. That's how I define this role. But we do have our, like I said, these portfolio and scaling departments where we have our offerings that take care of that scaling and that offering across regions, across sections. And we do have within our different sector specific GBLs and so on, we do have AI competence that takes these scalable architectures and makes them for their own sector. So make them more domain specific and so on. And so, adapt them. So we do it, but it's basically not in my realm of an AI lab to do that kind of things.
No, completely understand. Now, AI is so heavily reliant on data, Dr. Bob. How do you approach the challenge of data governance and data privacy, especially in view of such a immense data flow that keeps coming?
Yeah, Capgemini has traditionally been very good in scaling data ecosystems. That has been one of our strengths, I would say, during the years. And that didn't change. That part of it is still there. And we do actually have the responsibility for a lot of data ecosystems with our global multinational partner, the clients and partners. So we do that kind of things. Of course, AI brought something new to the table, this kind of AI, because we have been doing, of course, like everybody in this industry, AI for many years already. But the AI used to be a very technical thing. You take data from a data ecosystem, you build a model, you roll it out, and you have full control. And now all of a sudden, we have foundational models, for example, that come from the sideline. They are trained by a third party on data that is not fully disclosed with implications that we don't really know. And we are asked to inject that in our clients' ecosystems. This is an issue, of course, that we are very aware about and that we work hard on. But it also puts new constraints on how we can work with the data ecosystems of our customers. And also, it makes these data ecosystems that our customers have even more important, because also in the future, it will be data-driven, this AI, and the more and the better your data is, the more competitive advantage in your space you can create. So we see that the importance of these data ecosystems will not disappear. I don't think it will be automated either. We will see. Of course, partially it can be automated, but I think there's still a lot of work to be done to get data from observations in the real world into digital systems, into AI applications. And that will also be there in the future. But it will be a very interesting, and there is different requirements on data now. We have now automatic data generation with Gen AI. It's polluting sometimes what you want to register, what you want to observe. How do you cope with that? How do you recognize this kind of data? So there is a whole new set of tasks coming up that we need to be good at. And I'm sure it's a bit like spam in the old days. And there will be spam filters. And there will be technology that tackles that again. And then the next step, and this will not disappear anymore. This will be part of our business in the future. Yeah.
You're talking about synthetic data, Dr. Bob?
For example, fake news and whatever. Synthetic data is an innocent example because it's on purpose. But fake news is a worse example. This kind of technology can do a lot at the moment.
No, you're absolutely right. Dr. Bob, we talked about data and privacy. Let's just talk about the growing concern around AI bias and fairness. How does Capgemini approach these issues, and what measures do you have in place to make sure there is ethical AI development?
So we actually, I can brag a bit about Capgemini here, because I think we started our first ethical guidelines for AI in 2019 or 18 on group level. So we have launched ethical guidelines for AI pretty early. Of course, we have to update them now. We're working with that now. We have a group ethical officer, which actually we are cooperating with on updating these guidelines. So, but we do already have them for several years. And Capgemini, from my experience, also has seven core values in the company that we really take seriously. And they're also around ethics and fairness, like you say. So we actually have that in our DNA, I would say. And we use that in our projects and in the ways we tackle solutions.
So that's a little bit of a differentiator when you are talking to clients that, hey, we've been doing this. We can definitely make sure, because that's a big concern now for large organizations who are looking at implementing AI, Dr. Bob.
And it's also complicated, Sanjay, because we are working in all regions. And In India, one has a different stance on ethics and data. In America, it's a different thing, what you can do with health data. As in the EU, for example, we have a lot of discussion internally, of course, as well, with our own people in the single team.
It's not easy for our listeners who are dealing with this in global kind of a workplace. As you said, it's very different, Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob, can you elaborate a little bit on some of the AI technologies that you are utilizing, whether it's machine learning, deep learning, or NLP, et cetera, again, for your colleagues and peers?
Like I said, basically, we have been working with AI as such for a long time. So with all different types of AI, from the more early AIs, like decision trees even, we had projects with that. NLP, we have our own NLP groups and communities within the Capgemini. We have a community called the Knights of Knowledge, working on knowledge graph and logics and reasoning and planning systems. We have the deep learning stuff, of course, and now the Gen AI offerings and teams, and we combine them as well. So what we are doing with the lab now is also starting to build these hybrid AI solutions, where you actually use everything from more the symbolic AI kind of things, logic, reasoning, planning that I mentioned, to the connectionist stuff that we see nowadays with deep learning on image recognition, on sound, on sensors and sensing. We have a whole engineer department with 75,000 people doing a lot of stuff around sensing on the edge as well. And we combine that with generative AI and the LLMs and the diffusion models. So we have this whole package. And we, of course, we use what's necessary for a given task. And that is also part of the learning. So what do you use where and when and how and why?
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Dr. Bob, for some of our listeners, some of your peers, how important is it to have a strong data science team for successful AI adoption? Let's say someone is setting up, your client is setting up an AI team, or they were looking to implement enterprise AI. How important is it for them to have a strong data science team internally?
If you want to have a competitive advantage in this market, you need to have people that are knowledgeable quite close to the data that you generate. So having a good, strong data science team that understands your domain, understands your data, is of course a good idea. But we see typically one of the successful ways of doing that is that you have your teams with your domain experts and you make them scalable. So for example, in cooperation with Capgemini, where you can set up your own data science teams, they do the POCs, they know the data, they try and test out things. But they're typically not good in scaling solutions and bringing them back to the global realm. And that's where Capgemini can cooperate, setting up good infrastructures for having your AI-assisted platforms internally and make them scalable and so on. So that kind of cooperations we see more and more. And that's actually a change, because in 2018, when I started in Capgemini, our clients didn't have so many data scientists. It really is something that many of them started to build in the last years. And we see the effects of that. So for me, it's more fun because my clients know much better what they want. They're much smarter in ordering now because they have people with the right competence. So it's much more fun to work together at the moment than it used to be before, because there it was just like, make this for me. And we were building it. But now it is really an interaction with domain experts that also know about data analysis and AI. And that's cool. That's much, much better. I think that's where we're heading.
Dr. Bob, in your experience, in your vast experience, what are some of the significant barriers that you see to AI adoption, and how do we overcome those?
AI adoption is, of course, also all about organizational changes and understanding your business. And what I lack a bit in many organizations at the moment is really having a good AI vision and AI strategy on board level. That hasn't really arrived yet. Everybody is actually asking the question, what can we do with AI? But very often the expected answer is a use case or two. And that is not good enough at this time. You need to be much further than that. You really need to be on the level of okay, what is my vision? Where do we want our company to be in 2-3 years? And what is the role of automation, I would say? What can we automate? It can be a bridge between two buildings. It can be a conveyor belt, or it can be something digital. It might even be something with AI. And if it's AI, it also might be some Gen AI. But don't start just with two use cases in Gen AI. It will not change your business. And that is one of the issues for adoption. I think really having this discussion at board level and accepting that there are implications and start to implement for them. And some organizations are very mature in that, and others are simply not started yet on that journey. So I always ask that question when I come to a new company. What does your board say about AI?
Mm-hmm.
And if they just order use cases, you should probably go back to them, which is an interesting thing.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great point. So make sure you get the top level buy-in from the board to the C-level exec.
It's more than a buy-in, Sanjay, I would say. It should be in their DNA. They should really accept this as the challenge to solve. It's not only a buy-in that somebody else is going to do something for you in this. It should be in their own DNA at this time, because it's really going to change your whole business and your setup and your organization. And that should really be in all discussions at the moment. How do we do that? How do we prepare for that? And what kind of strategy do we have for this, and how are we going to adapt our organization? And at the moment, it is still very much, let us see if we can do something with AI.
Mm.
And that is not serious enough. But it also, what is the other, there is more obstructions, of course. One of the things that really stops you from doing good work with AI is that you don't have control about your own data, for example. You were into that before. So that is also a stopper. Or that you don't have the right guidelines for your people. You have to educate your people. There is severe risks in this technology in the sense that these are foundational models that you don't have control about yourself. So you need to understand what they do. You have to understand how you implement them in your infrastructure, what the implications are. If there is a person in your, say that you're a bank and you're very depending on high security in your whole infrastructure, and one of your IT people is uploading security logs from the security system to ChatGPT to find out what's wrong with them, you have a severe risk. And I promise you, there's a lot of people that don't understand these kind of things. So you need to make sure your whole organization has this kind of guidelines for what they can do, what they shouldn't do, and why. And this understanding is not easy to get. It's complex. It's a complex message. And you need to get some, to build up some competency in your organization.
So you made some very important points. One is obviously the board level, C-level people need to make it part of their DNA. Second is, you're saying is, where is your data? Is it quality data? And third is your people, making sure whether it's security or things of that nature, they are guided through this process. So those three things are very important, according to you, Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob, moving to the point of getting AI talent to look at different entities, there is this whole movement of bright AI talent going in for all these sexy Silicon Valley type companies, maybe even companies like Mistral or LF Alpha or Anthropic or others around the world. But there are some, the real work is being done by companies that are doing manufacturing, they're in agriculture, in healthcare, in biosciences. Mm-hmm. They're actually going to be doing what this technology's potential is, and they also need that talent. So coming to that and talking a little bit about Capgemini and overall, how do you foster a culture of innovation and experimentation within your AI lab? And how do you encourage your team to push the boundaries of AI?
Within my lab, it's easy because we are an R&D department. So we go to conferences, we test new, we reach out to companies that are coming with new technology, new models, new AI techniques, and we actually experiment together with them and we learn. So in that sense, it's okay. But then reaching out to 350,000 colleagues is much more of a problem. So how do you do that? How do you make sure that you actually reach the right people at the right time in your own organization? So that is a challenge. But also attracting new talents to Capgemini is an interesting one and very regionally different, I would say. It's a very different process if you're in Mumbai or you're in Oslo, in Norway, to attract new talent. So in Northern Europe, we try to be very present at universities. We actually also participate in courses every now and then, giving them the business perspective on what they learn at the university. But also there is often AI days or student days where we present and show off and show what we are doing. There is the big trade fairs where we actually go and try to attract talent with showing them what we are doing and how innovative we could be. And that works very, very well. And of course, the thought leading on the internet, all these different channels on the internet is very important.
Talk a little bit about, and in some ways you have, because you have such a globally dispersed talent pool, but maybe for our listeners, why is diversity and inclusion within an AI team at Capgemini and for others, why is that important for driving innovation?
Even if it is to actually keep your brain going, 10 brains that think in the same direction will not reach the same thing as 10 brains that have different perspectives. So that's why I really love and endorse diversity. I always have had teams that are very diverse. And I can give you an example, Sanjay. I reckon your background is somehow more APAC, more Indian than mine.
Yes.
In my team, I have a young Indian Hindustan woman. We were working on a multi-agent system. And what I actually asked her is to write down in what way she would build a multi-agent system from an Hindustan background. And this was so interesting because what I got back after a few weeks was 25 pages I didn't understand. I had to read it three times. No, but really, and that's what I asked her for. But I had to read it three times, literally, to get a grasp of where she was going, what her perspective was. And then it occurred to me that this was the solution to one of the problems we had. I just needed to read it. But this was so far outside of my, I wouldn't call it comfort zone, but more my experience and my cultural background, that it really gave me something new. And that is the real power of diversity. And the same holds for foundational models. If they're not built with data that's created by a very diverse set of people. I don't know if you've been at the TEDAI last November, there was a woman talking about Africa. And she said the problem with foundational models is that they don't model my culture, because in the culture where I come from, where I was raised, or I don't know if it was she or family or whatever, but there was no written words. So they only spoke about concepts, and they had a different experience of the world and a different feeling about the world. It was not written down. It was not recorded. It was not available as training data. So it was not in these models. So you miss out on a lot of good ideas and cultures if you don't do that. So there's a high need for this diversity, I would say, Sanjay. And I really mean that. I experienced it on my own, in my own world many times. I mean, Amsterdam, where I was born and raised, there was 174 different nationalities in that city. It was a multinational city from the early days. And I see the value in that. And I think AI needs it definitely.
You made some very important points. Some of them, most of them I'm very passionate about. I think what you're saying is diversity actually adds value. But I give you a lot of credit that you had the patience to read her three times, because most people would have not done that, or they would have just ingested it into ChatGPT and said, give me a summary of this.
but that's all about having a lab. It's about curiosity and learning. Yeah. If you don't have the patience to learn, you're probably in the wrong place.
Wrong place, absolutely. But you're so right. We get so much. And one of the challenges that, Dr. Bob, that exists is a lot of these foundation models are trained in Silicon Valley on English and Western cultures. You talked about this lady at TED talking about from Africa, but there are smaller countries even in Europe, like Finland and others, who have their language, which are difficult. And we've had those guests over, and we need to make sure that they don't get lost in this. And what you're talking about, diversity, I think is a very important point. One of the questions that came to us from our guest was that, what is a typical workday for Dr. Bob?
What is a typical workday from Dr. Bob? Yeah, there is no. Yeah. During Corona, the typical workday was stand up, go to the bathroom, go to the kitchen, go to your computer, and do the opposite in the evening. When we got ChatGPT, let me say it, maybe say it like that. After ChatGPT came, the world actually became very involved in the debate on AI. And that is something we have been looking for decades, and now it's there. The debate of AI has landed. My own mother is asking about it. My own wife listens to podcasts about it. She never had any interest in it. So that is new. So the day in the life of Dr. Bob has been running around and trying to make sure that everybody understood the complexity and didn't do stupid things. That was the first year, I would say. And I mean, in a company like Capgemini, it was also like, you have budgets that are assigned every year. So people are assigned to budgets and roles. And then ChatGPT came in the middle of it. Being agile with 350,000 people and a huge budget is not easy. I think we managed well. But after the 1st of January this year, when you had the new budget rounds and people get assigned to new roles and everything was much more streamlined towards tackling this AI debate. So now my day is really the lab, doing the innovation, reaching out to the interesting organizations or people around the world that have something to add. We have three focus areas in the lab that I follow up upon with my team. So within that realm, we are now trying to get forward and do the innovation. And we are quite successful in that now. So the day is really about reaching out to these people, discussing with what we could do, and also reserving time to sit down and think and read three times what your teammates make. And actually try to understand. So I try to balance the hectic 30-minute team meetings, whatever meetings, with sitting for a long time and having the long thoughts. And actually, I'm also Norwegian. And of course, I have a sauna. So being in a sauna for a few hours and actually get your long thoughts working and read and digest is just as important. ChatGPT cannot help much with that.
So one of the messages for Chief AI Officer is get a sauna, because that's where Dr. Bob gets most
like
of
the
us.
Conclusion, Sanjay.
Yeah,
most of it. About.
Forget about everything else. Just get the sauna. But no, those are great points you made. One other question that came for you was, does Capgemini have a plan for upskilling or education for the workforce to prepare them for an AI-driven future, Dr. Bob?
Yeah, we didn't really discuss it yet, but Capgemini started in Paris in 1967 and became very successful and bought a little castle outside of Paris. It's called La Fontaine, and that is the Capgemini University now. So we do have a whole university there with a huge auditoriums and so on, and hotels, and this castle for the dinners, of course, and a park for walking, having some longer thoughts and longer discussions. And we have La Fontaine also did this Capgemini University online as well. So we do have a lot of learning paths and learning materials. We got very many different promotion paths, tracks for with AI, but also in different roles. So architecture, sales, people management, all this kind of different tracks that you can follow in a company like ours. We have a lot of support for that in actually formalized and structured ways. We have an architect community on global level, with four levels of architects that is very successful, that we bring into that again. It really means something to follow this educational courses. And there is a lot of networking going on. You get mentoring setups. It's really, if you're young and you want to have a chance to really show off in some areas, or maybe you want to find out where you can show off. Because in my case, when I got my master's, I didn't feel that I knew anything. So I didn't even try to find a job because I thought I couldn't do anything. I was not good enough. That's why I took a PhD. Just because I thought I was not good enough to work. I didn't feel smart enough for that. But then once you got your PhD with AI and you come to a country like Norway with 5 million people at that time, 4.5, and there was only 40 people that knew what AI was in the whole country, you still didn't get a job. And then you had to find out what to do. So then I started to find out in different directions. In a company like Capgemini, there is so many different ways you can go and so many locations you can work at and sectors and everything, that it's a very nice way to find out where you shine and where your talents are. And also you can develop your talents in all different directions. So it's very flexible. But I like that about Capgemini, really. Yeah.
That's fantastic. You have a university, you have professional tracks that go out for people, and there's mentoring and other networking opportunities to
Definitely.
Go and get yourselves done. Dr. Bob, how do you envision the future of AI in the next decade, and what role do you see Capgemini playing in that?
Yeah, very good question again. Of course, it's the next decade is very long. Huh? The timelines
maybe
that
a year
are
or
shorter
years.
And shorter.
Yeah, maybe but, 2 years, year or 2 years.
Yeah, but I think what we will see, and the long-term AI proposal is, of course, that AI becomes autonomous. It becomes something that can play a role on its own. At the moment, it's still very much human-controlled. I think we will see AI that is actually able to be autonomous in that sense. I also think we need to adapt to that. We need to actually learn how to tackle that. And I think as a society at large, we need to actually build in the checks and balances for that kind of scenarios. And we don't have them at the moment. There is not really something else as human mankind that is, we are threatening ourselves, but there is nothing else than human mankind that is threatening us. There's no alien on this planet yet. But I think if these robots, if AI becomes autonomous, it might be like an alien on the planet, all of us. And how are we going to react to that? How are we going to prepare for that? So that is one of the things. And it will not, maybe, I don't think it will be, I think it will be able to help us very much. So AI will develop in that area where you can actually expect a lot of good results in health services, in societal issues. And there is always a threat, as with all technology. It will be used by the bad guys as well. And how are we going to tackle that? And you already see that at the moment in the Ukraine, at the battlefield, drones are made autonomous already. And so this is also changing very fast. And I think the world in 3 to 5 years from now will be maybe not recognizable. I would love to have this podcast with you in a few years, Sanjay, and just look back, because it is very difficult to predict. But I think autonomy is the key word, I think.
Autonomy.
Maybe one example and a kind example. Car makers, I think as soon as cars are really autonomous, and that might be a bit away, but say that they become really autonomous, nobody needs to own a car anymore. So it will change the structure of cities. It will change the sizes of the roads. So it will change everything. Yeah, because in the morning, if I need a car, it will be there. It's not my car. It will come from somewhere. These cars are maintained somewhere. It doesn't really matter where. It doesn't need to be in the center of the city. So the whole city will change. Like the whole layout society will change. And that's only one example. There will be many things that are autonomous. So I think that will be the biggest change that we can partially looking forward to.
That's
true. Some people will regret it and look back to the old times. Maybe I'm one of them. I don't know. We'll see.
That is true. As you said, we'll do a podcast in 2-3 years. Maybe it'll be not me, but an AI, Sanjay, will be doing that podcast and talking to you. So we never know, Dr.
Maybe
Bob.
We'll talk to my AI.
Talk to your AI and say, hey, look at what they were talking about. So that, I think, is going to be interesting to see. Dr. Bob, talking a little bit about talent, when you look to hire somebody yourself, and it's a two-part question. What do you look for in that person? This is for people who are looking to join your lab or join Capgemini. That's question one on talent, but I have another one, but please.
What I look for is people that are knowledgeable in the field that we need, and that doesn't have to be AI per se. It can also be surrounding fields. AI is a very multidisciplinary thing, but also people that are asking questions and are curious. Curiosity is very important, I think. Ambition to be knowledgeable and sharing and fair, that is important for me. So that's my personal thing. That's the kind of people I like to work with, and that share their knowledge, that are fair in their sharing, that also expect things and require things. Ambitions are fine, but they should be fair. And that is the most important, I think, that respect for each other. That's what we are looking for if we employ. People need, of course, to be able to work together. And I think diversity is very important. So also neurodiversity is very important in teams. Mm-hmm. We have one startup in Norway that I love. It's a startup with I think 20, 25 people that are doing software testing, and many of these people are autistic. And it is very nice because they are very good in their job, and they get it's a very interesting company and very successful as well. That is the kind of things that you can imagine, eh? If you have a team that is very diverse on all possible ways, it is difficult on the personal, social. It can be difficult. It doesn't have to be. Often it goes very well. The teams that I've been leading, I'm always looking for what is lacking, what kind of perspective is lacking, how can we find it? So when I employ a new person, besides of knowledgeable and fair and sharing, I also look at, okay, does it fit in that perspective that we're missing?
So someone obviously who has a base level of knowledge, someone who's curious, someone who's fair, someone who can share, and also someone that can fill in a gap that you might not have.
You have people that are very good in starting new initiatives and build quick and dirty prototypes in a few days. Mm-hmm. And you got people that can finish them and execute them and make final products out of them. You need that kind of dimensions as well. It's a very multidimensional problem, of course. But I think that's what we're looking for. People that are fair, that respect each other, and that actually adhere to the values of Capgemini. And they're well documented on the internet, so you can find them there. But that is the kind of people I personally look for. Yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Dr. Bob, towards the end, we do a lightning round of questions where we like a one-word answer. In your case, we might make an exception or take two words. Are you ready for this?
So yes.
Let's go. Dr. Bob, GPUs or TPUs?
GPUs.
Okay. Python or R?
R.
Okay. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. TensorFlow or PyTorch?
I think PyTorch.
PyTorch. Okay. Cloud or on-prem?
Both.
Okay. Supervised or unsupervised learning?
Both.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, and I think I did, but this is open source or proprietary AI software?
I'm a big fan of open source, I must say. Yeah. But there are cases where proprietary is very fine.
Well, that was fantastic. Dr. Bob, for our audience, you've been so incredible. What final words of wisdom or recommendations do you have for our listeners who are basically navigating their own journeys in AI leadership roles or companies that are looking to set up AI departments or bring on a chief AI officer? What would be your final word of wisdom for them?
I would say stay curious and true to yourself, which is a very general advice. Personally, I also have always struggled to lead people in tasks that I couldn't do myself. So I was studying psychology, cognitive psychology and AI, but I was also doing welding courses. So doing very different things, stay curious, stay true to yourself. And in my case, I really want to be able to execute tasks before I discuss them with other people. Yeah, that is my word of advice.
Well, that's fantastic. Stay curious, stay true to your advice. And if you're going to ask somebody else to do it, make sure you do it before you ask somebody else to do what you're asking them to do.
Great. Sometimes it's impossible because you cannot do everything, but it gives you a broadness in your discussion with people. That is very helpful, I found.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Dr. Bob, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the CIO podcast. Your insights into the world of AI and the transformative work being done at Capgemini are truly inspiring. And thank you for sharing your expertise with us today. And to our listeners, stay tuned and stay connected for more conversations with leading AI experts. Until next time, this is Sanjay Puri signing off from the CIO podcast. Dr. Bob, this was fantastic. I could have gone on I had so many other questions, so much I wanted to do, but we'll need to have you back. So thank you for being with us. It's been truly a pleasure.
Thank you, Sanjay. Pleasure was on my side.
Wonderful.